you have read here grew up under those conditions.
When the woman who has begun by loving too much finally realizes that she has tried everything to change her man and that her best efforts have failed, perhaps she is able to see that she must get help. Usually the help she seeks involves turning to someone else, perhaps a professional, in one more attempt to change her man. It is crucial that the person to whom she turns helps her recognize that she is the one who must change, that her recovery must begin with herself. This is very important because loving too much is a progressive disease, as has been so clearly demonstrated. A woman like Margot is on her way toward dying. Perhaps death will come from a stress-related disorder, such as heart failure, or a stroke, or any other physical ailment caused or exacerbated by stress. Or she may die by the violence that has now become so much a part of her life, or perhaps in an accident that wouldn't have occurred if she hadn't been distracted by her obsession. She may die very quickly or spend many years in progressive deterioration. Whatever the apparent cause of death, I want to reiterate that loving too much can kill you. Now let us return to Margot, dismayed by the turn of events in her life, and at least for the moment, tentatively looking for help. Margot really has only two choices. She needs to have them delineated clearly for her, and then she must choose between them. She can continue to search for the perfect partner. Given her predilection for hostile, untrustworthy men, she will inevitably be drawn to more of the same types she has already known. Or she can begin the very difficult and demanding task of bringing into conscious awareness her unhealthy patterns of relating, while objectively scrutinizing the ingredients that have added up to attraction between herself and various men. She can either continue to look outside herself for the man who will make her happy, or she can begin the slow and painstaking, but ultimately far more rewarding, process of learning to love and nurture herself with the help and support of peers. Sadly, the vast majority of women like Margot will choose to continue practicing their addiction, searching for the magic man who will make them happy, or endlessly trying to control and improve the man they are with. It seems so much easier and feels so much more familiar to keep on looking for a source of happiness outside oneself than to practice the discipline required to build one's own inner resources, to learn to fill the emptiness from inside rather than outside. But for those of you who are wise enough, weary enough, or desperate enough to want to get well more than you want to either fix the man you are with or find a new one, for those of you who really do want to change yourself, the steps of recovery follow. Chapter 10, The Road to Recovery. Having read in these pages of so many women who are so much alike in their unhealthy ways of relating, perhaps you believe by now that this is a disease. What, then, is its appropriate treatment? How can a woman caught in its grip recover? How does she begin to leave behind that endless series of struggles with him and learn to use her energies in creating a rich and fulfilling existence for herself? And how does she differ from the many women who do not recover, who are never able to extricate themselves from the mire and the misery of unsatisfactory relationships? It is certainly not the severity of her problems that determines whether or not a woman will recover. Before recovery, women who love too much are very much alike in character, regardless of the specific details of any present circumstances or past histories. But a woman who has overcome her pattern of loving too much is profoundly different from who and what she was prior to recovery. Perhaps, until now, it was luck or fate that has determined which of these women would find her way and which wouldn't. However, My observation has been that all women who do recover have eventually taken certain steps in order to do so. Through trial and error, and often without guidelines, they nevertheless, again and again, ultimately followed the program of recovery I will outline for you. Further, in my personal and professional experience, I have never seen a woman who took these steps fail to recover, and I have never seen a woman recover who failed to take these steps. If that sounds like a guarantee, it is. Women who follow these steps will get well. The steps are simple, but not easy. They are all equally important and are listed in the most chronologically typical order. Step 1. Go for help. Step 2. Make your own recovery the first priority in your life. Step 3. Find a support group of peers who understand. Step 4. Develop your spiritual side through daily practice. Step 5. Stop managing and controlling others. Step 6. Learn to not get hooked into the games. Step 7. Courageously face your own problems and shortcomings. Step 8. Cultivate whatever needs to be developed in yourself. Step 9. Become selfish. Step 10. Share with others what you have experienced and learned. One by one, we will explore what each of these steps means, what it requires, why it is necessary, and what its implications are. Step 1. Go for help. What it means. The first step in going for help may involve anything from checking a relevant book out of the library, which can take enormous courage, it feels as if everyone is watching, to making an appointment to see a therapist. It may mean an anonymous call to a hotline to talk about what you've always tried so hard to keep secret, or contacting an agency in your community that specializes in the kind of problem you're facing, whether it's codependence, a history of incest, a partner who is battering you, or whatever. It may mean finding out where a self-help group meets and getting up the courage to go, or taking a class through adult education, or going to a counseling center that deals with your type of problem. It may even mean calling the police. Basically, going for help means doing something, taking the first step, reaching out. It is very important to understand that going for help does not mean threatening your partner with the fact that you are thinking of doing so. Such a move is usually an attempt to blackmail him into shaping up so that you don't have to publicly expose him for the terrible person he is. Leave him out of it. Otherwise, going for help, or threatening to do so, is just one more attempt to manage and control him. Try to remember, you are doing this for you. What going for help requires. To go for help, you must, at least temporarily, give up the idea that you can handle it alone. You must face the reality that, over time, things have gotten worse in your life, not better, and realize that in spite of your best efforts, you are not able to solve the problem. This means that you must become honest with yourself about how bad it really is. Unfortunately, this honesty comes to some of us only when life has dealt us such a blow, or series of blows, that we've been knocked to our knees and are gasping for breath. Since that's usually a temporary situation, the moment we're able to function again, we try to pick up where we left off, being strong, managing, controlling, and going it alone. Do not settle for temporary relief. If you start by reading a book, then you need to take the step after that, which is probably to contact some of the sources for help that the book recommends. If you make an appointment with a professional, find out whether that person understands the dynamics of your particular problem. If, for instance, you've been a victim of incest, Someone without special training and expertise in that area is not going to be nearly as helpful to you as someone who knows what you've gone through and how it has probably affected you. See someone who is able to ask questions about your family's history, similar to those raised in this book. You may want to know if your potential therapist agrees with the premise that loving too much is a progressive illness and accepts the treatment approach outlined here. My strong personal bias is that women should see women counselors. We share the basic experience of what it is to be a woman in this society, and this creates a special depth of understanding. We are also able to avoid the almost inevitable man-woman games we might be tempted to play with a male therapist, or which, unfortunately, he might be tempted to play with us. But just seeing a woman is not enough. She must also be aware of the most effective methods of treatment, depending on which factors are present in your history, and be willing to refer you to an appropriate peer support group. Indeed, even to make participation in such a group a mandatory element of treatment. For example, I will not counsel someone who is codependent unless she becomes involved in Al-Anon. If she is unwilling to do so after several visits, I make an agreement with her that should she become willing to do so, I will see her again, but not otherwise. My experience teaches me that without involvement in Al-Anon, codependents do not recover. Instead, they repeat their patterns of behavior and continue their unhealthy ways of thinking, and therapy alone is not enough to turn this around. With both therapy and Al-Anon, however, recovery happens much more quickly. These two treatment aspects complement each other very well. Your therapist should have a similar requirement that you join a self-help group that is appropriate for you. Otherwise, she may be enabling you to complain about your situation without requiring that you do all you can to help yourself. Once you find someone who is good, you must stick with her and follow her recommendations. No one ever changed a lifelong pattern of relating through just one or two visits to a professional. Going for help may require that you spend money, or it may not. Many agencies have sliding scales for fees according to your ability to pay, and there is no correlation between the most expensive therapist and the most effective treatment. Many very competent and dedicated individuals work for such agencies. What you are looking for is someone who has experience and expertise and is a person with whom you feel comfortable. Trust your feelings and be willing to see several therapists if necessary, in order to find one who is right for you. It is not absolutely necessary that you specifically enter therapy to recover. In fact, seeing the wrong therapist will do more harm than good. But someone who understands the disease process involved in loving too much can be of inestimable help to you. Going for help does not require that you be willing to terminate your present relationship if you are in one. Nor is that a requirement at any time throughout the process of recovery. As you follow these steps, 1 through 10, the relationship will take care of itself. When women come to see me, they often want to leave their relationship before they are ready, which means they will either go back or else begin a new, equally unhealthy one. If they follow these 10 steps, their perspective on whether to stay or to leave changes. Being with him ceases to be the problem, and leaving him ceases to be the solution. Instead, the relationship becomes one of the many considerations that must be addressed in the overall picture of how they live their lives. Why going for help is necessary. It is necessary because you've already tried so hard, and none of your best efforts have worked in the long run. Though they may have brought occasional temporary relief, the overall picture is one of progressive deterioration. The tricky part here is that you are probably not in touch with just how bad it has gotten, because you undoubtedly have a great measure of denial operating in your life. That is the nature of the disease. For instance, I've been told countless times by women clients that their children don't know anything is wrong at home, or that These children sleep through the nightly fights. This is a very common example of self-protective denial. If these women faced the fact that their children are truly suffering, they would be overwhelmed by guilt and remorse. On the other hand, their denial makes it very hard for them to see the severity of the problem and get the necessary help. Take for granted that your situation is worse than you will allow yourself to acknowledge at present, and that your disease is progressing. Understand that you require appropriate treatment, that you cannot do it alone. What going for help implies. One of the most feared implications is that the relationship, if there is one, may end. This is by no means necessarily true, although, should you follow these steps, I guarantee that the relationship will either improve or end. It and you will not stay the same. Another feared implication is that the secret is out. Once a woman has sincerely sought help, there is rarely regret for having done so, but the fear beforehand can be monumental. Whether the problems a given woman lives with are unpleasant and inconvenient or severely damaging and even life-threatening, she may or may not choose to go for help. It is the magnitude of her fear, and sometimes her pride as well, that determine whether she seeks help, and not the severity of her problems. For many women, reaching out does not even seem to be an option. To do so feels like taking an unnecessary risk in an already precarious situation. "I didn't want to make him angry," is the classic answer of the beaten wife when questioned as to why she didn't call the police. A deep and profound fear of making things worse and, ironically, a conviction that she can still control the situation somehow prohibit her from reaching out to authorities or to others who might help her. On a less dramatic scale, this is also true. A frustrated wife may not want to rock the boat because her husband's cold indifference to her is not that bad. She tells herself that he is basically a good man, free of many of the undesirable traits she sees in her friends' husbands. And so she puts up with a non-existent sex life, his discouraging attitude toward her every enthusiasm, or his preoccupation with sports during every waking moment of the time they share at home together. This is not tolerance on her part. It is a lack of trust that the relationship can survive her unwillingness to continue waiting patiently for his attention, which never comes, and it is, even more to the point, a lack of conviction that she deserves more happiness than she is getting. This is a key concept in recovery. Do you deserve better than your present circumstances? What are you willing to do to make it better for yourself? Begin at the beginning and go for help. Step 2. Make your own recovery your first priority. What it means. Making your own recovery your first priority means deciding that no matter what is required, you are willing to take those steps necessary to help yourself. Now, if that sounds extreme, think for a moment about to what lengths you would be willing to go to make him change, to help him recover. Then, just turn the force of that energy on yourself. The magic formula here is that although all your hard work and efforts cannot change him, you can, with that same expenditure of energy, change yourself. So use your power where it will do some good, on your own life. What making your own recovery your first priority requires. It requires a total commitment to yourself. This may be the first time in your life that you have regarded yourself as truly important, truly worthy of your own attention and nurturing. This is probably very hard for you to do, but if you go through the motions of keeping appointments, participating in a support group, and so on, you will be helped to learn how to value and promote your own well-being. So for a while, just make yourself show up, and the healing process will begin. Soon you will feel so much better that you'll want to continue. To help the process, be willing to educate yourself about your problem. If you grew up in an alcoholic family, for instance, read books on that subject. Go to relevant lectures on the subject and find out what is now known about the effects of that experience in later life. It will be uncomfortable and even painful sometimes to expose yourself to that input, but not nearly as uncomfortable as continuing to live out your patterns without any understanding of how your past controls you. With understanding comes the opportunity for choice, so the greater your understanding, the greater your freedom of choice. Also required is the willingness to continue to spend time and perhaps money, too, to get well. If you balk at spending time and money on your own recovery, if it seems wasteful, consider how much time and money you have spent trying to avoid the pain, either from being in your relationship or from having it end. Drinking, using drugs, eating too much, taking trips to get away from it all, having to replace things, either his or yours, that you've broken in fits of anger, missing work, expensive long-distance phone calls to him or to someone you hope will understand, buying him presents to make up, buying yourself presents to help you forget, spending days and nights crying over him, neglecting your health to the point where you become seriously ill. The list of ways you have spent time and money staying sick is probably long enough to make you very uncomfortable if you look at it honestly. Recovery requires that you be willing to invest at least that much in getting well. And as an investment, it is guaranteed to give you considerable returns. Total commitment to your own recovery also requires that you severely curtail or entirely suspend your own use of alcohol or other drugs while in the therapeutic process. The use of mind-altering substances during this time mitigates against your fully experiencing the emotions you will be uncovering, and it is only through deeply experiencing them that you will also gain the healing that comes with their release. Discomfort with and fear of these feelings may prompt you to want to dull them by one means or another, including using food as a drug. But I urge you not to. Most of the work of therapy happens during the hours when you are not in group or in session. My experience with clients is that whatever connections are made during therapy sessions or between them are of lasting value only if the mind is in an unaltered state while processing this material. Why making your own recovery your first priority is necessary. It is necessary because if you do not, you will never have time to get well. You will be too busy doing all the things that keep you sick. Just as learning a new language frequently requires repeated exposure to new sounds and patterns of speech that contradict the familiar ways of talking and thinking and cannot be grasped at all if that exposure is infrequent or sporadic, so recovery goes. An occasional half-hearted gesture of doing something for yourself will not be enough to affect the entrenched ways of thinking, feeling, and relating. Through habit alone, they would reassert themselves without remedial input. To help put it into perspective, consider the lengths to which you would be willing to go if you had cancer and someone offered you hope of recovery. Be willing to go to those same lengths to recover from this disease, which destroys the quality of life and possibly even life itself. What making your own recovery your first priority implies. Your appointments with your therapist or your time in group come first. They're more important than an invitation to have lunch or dinner with the man in your life, meeting your man to talk things over, avoiding his criticism or anger, making him or anyone else happy, getting his or anyone else's approval, taking a trip to get away from it all for a while, so you can return and endure some more of the same. Step 3. Find a support group of peers who understand. What it means. Finding a support group of peers who understand may require an effort. If you are or ever have been in a relationship with an alcoholic or drug abuser, go to Al-Anon. If you are the child of an alcoholic or drug abuser, again, Al-Anon is your best source of help. If you have been raped or otherwise physically or sexually abused, or if you do not fit any of these categories, or the specific group that best fits your needs does not exist in your community, find a support group in which women are dealing with their problems of emotional dependency on men, or start your own group. A support group of peers is not an unstructured meeting of women who talk about all the awful things men have done to them, or the unlucky hands that life has dealt them. Group is a place to work on your own recovery. It is important to talk about past traumas, but if you find yourself or others recounting long stories with lots of "he said" and then "I said" in them, you are probably off the track and possibly even in the wrong group. Empathy alone will not elicit recovery. A good support group is dedicated to helping all who attend get better, and includes some members who have achieved a measure of recovery themselves and can share with newcomers the principles by which they gained it. This is nowhere better modeled than in Al-Anon. Whether or not alcoholism has touched your life, you may want to attend one meeting or several to see how the principles of recovery work. They are basically the same for us all, no matter what our past or present circumstances. What a support group requires. You need to make a commitment to yourself and to the group to attend a minimum of 6 meetings before you decide that it has nothing to offer you. This is necessary because it takes that long for you to begin to feel like part of the group, to learn the jargon, if it exists, and to start to grasp the process of recovery. If you are going to Al-Anon, which often has several meetings each week, try to attend on different days. Different groups will have different characteristics, though the format is basically similar. Find one or two that especially suit you and stick with them, supplementing more meetings when you feel the need. It will be necessary to attend regularly. Though it is important to the others that you be there, your attendance is for your own benefit. In order to receive what the group has to offer, you must show up. Ideally, you will feel a certain level of trust, but even if that is not something you are yet able to muster, you can be honest. Talk about your lack of trust of people in general, of the group, of the process. Ironically, your trust will begin to grow. Why a support group of peers is necessary. As others share their stories, you will be able to identify with them and their experiences. They will help you to remember what you've blocked from your awareness, both events and feelings. You will become more in touch with yourself. As you find yourself identifying with others and accepting them in spite of their flaws and their secrets, you will be able to become more accepting of those characteristics and feelings in yourself. This is the beginning of the development of self-acceptance, which is an absolutely vital requirement for recovery. When you are ready, you will share some of your own experiences, and in doing so, you will become more honest and less secretive and afraid. Through the group's acceptance of what has been so unacceptable to you, your self-acceptance will grow. You will see others using techniques in their lives that work, which you can try for yourself. You will also see people trying things that don't work, and you can learn from their mistakes. Along with all the empathy and shared experience a group provides, there is an element of humor that is also vital to recovery. The understanding smiles of recognition at yet another attempt at managing someone else, the happy cheering when someone has gotten past an important hurdle, the release of laughter over shared idiosyncrasies, all are truly healing. You will begin to feel as if you belong. This is critically important for anyone coming from a dysfunctional family, since that experience produces such strong feelings of isolation. To be with others who both understand your experience and share it produces a sense of safety and well-being, which you need. What finding and joining a support group of peers implies. The secret is out. True, not everyone knows, but a few people do. You walk into Al-Anon, and there is the tacit assumption that sometime, somewhere, you've been affected by alcoholism. You show up at your local women's shelter to participate in a support group held there, and it indicates that to some degree, you have suffered from domestic violence, and so on. The fear that others will know keeps many people from getting the help that could salvage their lives and their relationships. Remember, in any valid support group, your attendance there and what is discussed there is information that never leaves the group. Your privacy is respected and protected. If it is not, you need to find a group where it is. On the other hand, going just once means that others know you have a problem. Hopefully, having read this far, you can see that letting a few others know, especially when they too share your problem, is a way out of your painful isolation. Step 4. Develop your spirituality through daily practice. What it means. Well, it means different things to different people. For some of you, the whole idea is immediately repellent, and you're probably wondering if you can skip this step. None of that God stuff for you. For you, such beliefs seem immature and naive, and you're too sophisticated to take any of it seriously. Others of you may already be praying determinedly to a God who doesn't seem to be listening. You've told him what's wrong and what needs fixing, and you're still miserable. Or maybe you've prayed so hard for so long with no visible results that you've gotten angry, given up, or feel betrayed and wonder what terrible thing you're being punished for. Whether or not you have a belief in God, and if you do, whether or not you're on speaking terms with him, you can still practice this step. Developing your spirituality can mean pretty much following whatever path you choose. Even if you are 100% atheist, perhaps you get pleasure and solace from a quiet walk, or contemplating a sunset or some aspect of nature. Whatever takes you beyond yourself and into a broader perspective on things is what this step is all about. Find out what brings you peace and serenity and commit some time, at least half an hour daily, to that practice. No matter how dismaying your circumstances, this discipline can bring you relief, even comfort. If you are on the fence about whether there is any such thing as a higher power in the universe, you might want to try acting as if you did believe, even if you don't. Beginning to turn over what you cannot manage to a power greater than yourself can bring enormous relief. Or, if this feels like you're being coerced into something you don't want to do, how about using your peer support group as a higher power? Certainly, there is more strength in the group than any one of you has all by yourself. Allow yourself to use the group as a whole for strength and support, or make a commitment to contact an individual member to help you through it when a rough time comes along. Know that you are no longer all alone. If you have an active faith and you regularly worship and frequently pray, developing your spirituality may mean trusting that what is happening in your life has its own reason and its own results, and that God is in charge of your partner, not you. Take quiet time to meditate and pray and to ask for guidance in how to live your own life while you release those around you to live theirs. Developing your spirituality, no matter what your religious orientation, basically means letting go of self-will, of the determination to make things happen the way you think they should. Instead, you must accept the fact that you may not know what is best in a given situation, either for yourself or for another person. There may be outcomes and solutions that you have never considered, or perhaps the ones you've most feared and tried hardest to forestall, may be exactly what is necessary in order for things to begin to improve. Self-will means believing that you alone have all the answers. Letting go of self-will means becoming willing to hold still, be open, and wait for guidance for yourself. It means learning to let go of fear, all of the what-ifs, and despair, all of the if-onlys, and replacing them with positive thoughts and statements about your life. What developing your spirituality requires. It requires willingness, not faith. Often with willingness comes faith. If you don't want faith, you probably won't get it, but you still may find more serenity than you've had before. Developing your spirituality also requires that you use affirmations to overcome old patterns of thinking and feeling and to replace old belief systems. Whether or not you have any belief in a higher power, affirmations can change your life. Use those that you find on the internet, or better yet, you can make up your own. Make them totally positive and repeat them silently, or out loud if possible, every chance you get. Just to get you started, here's one. I no longer suffer. My life is filled with joy, prosperity, and fulfillment. Why developing your spirituality is necessary. Without spiritual development, it is nearly impossible to let go of managing and controlling, and to believe that all will work out as it is meant to. Spiritual practice calms you and helps change your perspective from being victimized to being uplifted. It is a source of strength in crisis. When feelings or circumstances are overwhelming, you need a resource greater than yourself to which you can turn. Without spiritual development, it is nearly impossible to let go of self-will, and without letting go of self-will, you will not be able to take the next step. You will not be able to stop managing and controlling the man in your life, because you will still believe it is your job to do so. You will not be able to surrender control of his life to a force higher than yourself. What developing your spirituality implies. You are freed from the overwhelming responsibility of fixing everything, controlling the man in your life, and preventing disaster. You have tools for finding relief that don't require that you manipulate anyone else into doing or being what you want. No one has to change in order for you to feel good. Because you have access to spiritual nourishment, your life and your happiness come to be more under your own control and less vulnerable to the actions of others. Step 5. Stop managing and controlling him. What it means. To stop managing and controlling him means not helping and not giving advice. Let's please assume that this other adult whom you are aiding and advising has as much capacity as you have to find himself a job, an apartment, a therapist, an AA meeting, or whatever else he needs. He may not have as much motivation as you to find these things for himself or to work out his own problems, but when you take on trying to solve his problems for him, he is freed from his own responsibility for his life. You are then in charge of his welfare, and when your efforts on his behalf fail, you will be the one he blames. Let me give you an example of how this works. I frequently receive calls from wives and girlfriends who want to make an appointment for their partners. I always insist that those men make their own appointments with me. If the person who is supposed to be the client hasn't enough motivation to choose his own therapist and make his own appointment, how will he be motivated to stay in therapy and work on his own recovery? Earlier in my career as a therapist, I used to accept these appointments, only to get another call from the wife or girlfriend saying that he had changed his mind about seeing someone, or that he didn't want to see a woman therapist, or that he wanted to see someone with different credentials. These women would then ask if I could recommend someone else whom they could call to make another appointment for him. I learned never to take appointments made by someone for anyone else, and instead to ask these wives and girlfriends to come in to see me for themselves. Not managing or controlling him also means stepping out of the role of encouraging and praising him. Chances are you have also used these methods to try to get him to do what you'd like, and this means they have become tools for manipulating him. Praising and encouraging are very close to pushing, and when you do that, you are trying again to take control of his life. Think about why you are lauding something he's done. Is it to help raise his self-esteem? That's manipulation. Is it so he will continue whatever behavior you're praising? That's manipulation. Is it so that he'll know how proud you are of him? That can be a burden for him to carry. Let him develop his own pride from his own accomplishments. Otherwise, you come dangerously close to playing a mothering role with him. He doesn't need another mother, no matter how bad his mother was. And much more to the point, you don't need him to be your child. It means to stop watching. Pay less attention to what he is doing and more attention to your own life. Sometimes, as you begin to let go, your partner will up the ante, so to speak, to keep you hooked into watching and feeling responsible for the outcome. Things may suddenly go from bad to worse for him. Let them. His troubles are his own to work out, not yours. Let him take the full responsibility for his problems and the full credit for his solutions. Stay out of it. If you're busy with your own life and you're practicing your own spiritual development, you will more easily be able to take your eyes off him. It means detaching. Detaching requires that you get your ego disentangled from his feelings, and especially from his actions and their results. It requires that you allow him to deal with the consequences of his behavior. You don't save him from any of his pain. You may continue to care about him, but you don't take care of him. You allow him to find his own way, just as you are working to find yours. What stopping the managing and controlling of him requires? It requires learning to say and do nothing. This is one of the most difficult tasks you face in your recovery. When his life is unmanageable, when everything in you wants to take over, to advise and encourage him, to manipulate the situation in whatever way you can, you must learn to hold still, to respect this other person enough to allow the struggle to be his, not yours. It requires facing your own fears regarding what might happen to him and to your relationship if you let go of managing everything, and then going to work on eliminating your fears rather than manipulating him. It requires that you use your spiritual practice to uphold you when you become frightened. Your spiritual development is especially important as you learn to let go of feeling that you must run everything. It can actually feel physically as though you are falling off a cliff when you begin to let go of controlling others in your life. The sensation of being out of control of yourself when you release others from your attempts to control can be alarming. Here, your spiritual practice can help, because instead of letting go into a void, you can relinquish control of those you love to your higher power. It requires a hard look at what is, rather than what you hope will be. As you let go of managing and controlling, you must also let go of the idea that when he changes, I'll be happy. He may never change. You must stop trying to make him. And you must learn to be happy anyway. Why it is necessary to stop managing and controlling him. As long as you are focused on changing someone over whom you are powerless, and we are all powerless over changing anyone but ourselves, you cannot bring your energies to bear on helping yourself. Unfortunately, changing someone else appeals to us much more than working on ourselves. So until we give up the former notion, we'll never be able to get to work on the ladder. Most of the insanity and despair you experience comes directly from trying to manage and control what you cannot. Think about all the attempts you've made, the endless speeches, the pleading, threats, bribes, maybe even violence, all the avenues you've tried that haven't worked. And remember how you felt after each failed attempt. Your self-esteem slipped another notch, and you became more anxious, more helpless, more angry. The only way out of all this is to let go of the attempt to control what you cannot, him and his life. Finally, it is necessary to stop because he will almost never change in the face of pressure from you. What should be his problem begins to look like your problem, and somehow you end up stuck with it unless you let go. Even if he does attempt to placate you with some promise of changing his ways, he will probably revert back to his old behavior, often with much resentment toward you when he does so. Remember, if you are the reason he gives up a behavior, you'll also be the reason he resumes it. Example. Two young people are in my office, referred by his probation officer because of alcohol or drug offenses. He is there because he's in trouble with the law. She's there because she tries to go everywhere with him. She sees it as her job to keep him on the straight and narrow. As is so common in such cases, both of them come from homes where there is alcoholism in at least one parent. As they sit before me, holding hands, they tell me they are going to get married. "I think getting married will help him," the young woman says, sometimes with shy compassion, sometimes with firm determination. "Yeah," he nods sheepishly. "She keeps me from getting too wild. She helps me a lot." There is a note of relief in his voice, and his girlfriend glows with pleasure at the faith he has in her, at the responsibility for his life that she has been given. And I try, gently, in the face of their hope and their love, to explain that if he has a problem with alcohol or other drugs, and she is the reason he slows down or stops drinking or using drugs now, she will also be the reason he speeds up or starts drinking and using drugs all over again later. I warn them both that someday he will say to her in the middle of an argument, "I quit for you, and what difference has it made? You're never happy, so why should I keep trying?" Soon, they will be torn apart by the very forces that seem now to bring them together. What the implications are when you stop managing and controlling him. He may become very angry and accuse you of not caring about him anymore. This anger generates from his panic at having to become responsible for his own life. As long as he can fight with you, make you promises, or try to win you back, his struggle is outside with you and not inside with himself. Sound familiar? It's true for you too, as long as your struggle is with him. You may find there is very little to talk about once all the cajoling, arguing, threatening, fighting, and making up stops. It's okay. Say your affirmations quietly to yourself in the silence. It is very likely that once you truly let go of managing and controlling him, a great deal of your energy will be freed up that you can then use for exploring, developing, and enhancing yourself. It is important to know, however, that the temptation will be there to again look outside yourself for raison d'être. Curb this inclination and stay focused on yourself. It is only fair to mention that as you let go of the role of smoothing out his life, things may get chaotic, and you may receive some criticism from people who don't understand what you are doing or not doing. Try not to be defensive, and don't bother going into detailed explanations for them. If you like, recommend they read this book, and then drop the subject. If they persist, avoid them for a while. Usually, such criticism is far less frequent and far less intense than we both expect and fear. We are our own worst critics, and we project our expectation of criticism out onto those around us, seeing it and hearing it everywhere. Be on your own side in all this, and the world will magically become a more approving place. One of the implications of letting go of managing and controlling others is that you must relinquish the identity of being helpful. But ironically, that very act of letting go is frequently the single most helpful thing you can do for the one you love. The identity of being helpful is an ego trip. If you really want to be helpful, let go of his problems and help yourself. Step 6. Learn to not get hooked into the games. What it means. The concept of games as they apply to dialogue between two people comes from the type of psychotherapy known as transactional analysis. Games are structured ways of interacting that are employed to avoid intimacy. Everybody resorts to games in their interactions sometimes, but in unhealthy relationships, the games abound. They are stereotyped ways of responding that serve to circumvent any genuine exchange of information and feelings, and allow the participants to put the responsibility for their well-being or distress in each other's hands. Typically, the roles played by women who love too much, and their partners, are varieties of the rescuer, persecutor, and victim positions. Each of the pair plays each of these roles many times in a typical exchange. We will designate the role of rescuer and define it as trying to help, the role of persecutor and define it as trying to blame, and the role of victim and define it as the one who is blameless and helpless. The following script will illustrate how this game works. Tom, who often comes home late, has just arrived in his bedroom. It's 11:30 p.m., and his wife, Mary, begins. Mary, tearfully, the victim.
Where were you? I've been so worried I couldn't sleep. I was so afraid there'd been an accident. You know how I worry. How could you let me lie here like this, and not at least call to let me know you were still alive?
Tom, placating, the rescuer.
Oh, honey, I'm sorry. I thought you'd be asleep, and I didn't want to wake you up by calling. Don't be upset. I'm home now, and I'll call next time, I promise. As soon as I get ready for bed, I'll rub your back, and you'll feel better.
Mary, getting angry, the persecutor.
I don't want you to touch me. You say you'll call next time. That's a joke. You told me the last time this happened that you'd call, and did you? No. You don't care if I lie here, thinking of you dead out on the highway. You never think of anybody else, so you don't know how it feels to worry about somebody you love.
Tom, helplessly, the victim.
Honey, that's not true. I was thinking of you. I didn't want to wake you. I didn't know you'd be upset. I was just trying to be thoughtful. Seems like no matter what I try, I'm wrong. What if I'd called you and you were asleep? Then I'd be a jerk for waking you up. I can't win.
Mary, relenting, the rescuer.
Now, that's not true. It's just that you're so important to me. I want to know that you're all right, not run over somewhere. I'm not trying to make you feel bad. I just want you to understand that I worry about you because I love you so much. I'm sorry I got so mad.
Tom, sensing an edge. The persecutor.
Well, if you worry so much, why aren't you glad to see me when I get home? How come you hit me with all this whining about where I was? Don't you trust me? I'm getting tired of having to explain everything to you all the time. If you trusted me, you'd go to sleep. And when I got home, you'd be glad to see me instead of jumping all over me. Sometimes I think you just like to fight.
Mary, voice rising, the persecutor.
Glad to see you. After lying here for 2 hours wondering where you were? If I don't trust you, it's because you never do anything to help me build that trust. You don't call. You blame me for being upset and then accuse me of not being nice to you when you finally drag in the door. Why don't you just turn around and go back wherever you came from, wherever you've been all evening?
Tom, soothing, the rescuer.
Look, I know you're upset, and I've got a big day tomorrow. How about if I make you a cup of tea? That's what you need. Then I'll take a shower and come to bed, okay?
Mary, crying, the victim.
You just don't understand how it feels to be waiting and waiting, knowing that you could call, but don't, because I'm not that important to you.
Shall we stop here? As you can probably see, these two could go on trading places on their triangle of positions as rescuer, persecutor, and victim for many more hours or days, even years. If you find yourself responding to any statement or action of another person from any of these positions, beware. You are participating in a no-win cycle of accusation, rebuttal, blame, and counterblame that is pointless, futile, and degrading. Stop. Let go of trying to make it turn out the way you want it to by being nice, being angry, or being helpless. Change what you can, which means change yourself. Stop needing to win. Stop even needing to fight or to make him give you a good reason or excuse for his behavior or neglect. Stop needing him to be sufficiently sorry. What not getting hooked into the games requires. Not getting hooked requires that even though you are tempted to respond in any one of the ways you know will keep the game going, you don't. You respond in a way that will end the game. It's a little tricky at first, but with practice, you'll easily master it if you also master your need to play the games in the first place, which is part of the previous step, letting go of managing and controlling. Let's look again at the situation and see how Mary could stay off that deadly triangle with Tom. By now, Mary has started developing her spirituality, and she is aware that she has no business trying to manage and control Tom. Because she is working on taking care of herself, earlier this evening, when it began to get late and Tom hadn't come home, instead of allowing herself to get nervous and worked up about it, she called a friend in her support group. They talked about her mounting fear, which helped to calm her. Mary needed someone to hear how she felt, and her friend listened with understanding, but without giving advice. After she hung up, she practiced one of her favorite affirmations. My life is divinely guided, and I grow in peace, security, and serenity every day, every hour. Since no one can hold two separate thoughts at once, Mary found that as she gave her thoughts over to the soothing words of the affirmation, she became calm and even relaxed. By the time Tom got home at 11:30, she was asleep. He woke her when he came into the room, and she immediately felt the annoyance and anger returning, so she repeated her affirmation to herself a couple of times and said, "Hi, Tom. I'm glad you're home." Now, Tom has always been used to a battle under these circumstances and was a little nonplussed at her casual greeting. "I was going to call you, but..." He begins his excuse defensively. Mary waits till he's finished and says, "We can talk about it in the morning if you like. I'm too sleepy now. Good night." If Tom was feeling guilty about the lateness of the hour, a fight with Mary would actually have eased his guilt. He could then tell himself that she was a nagging shrew, and the problem would become hers for nagging instead of his for being late. As it is, he's left with his guilt, and she's not suffering because of his actions. That's the way it should be. It's kind of like a game of ping pong, when you're both doing the rescuer, persecutor, victim thing. You keep hitting the ball back when it comes your way. In order not to get hooked into playing, you have to learn to let the ball go right past you, off the end of the table. One of the greatest ways of letting it go is to cultivate the use of the word, "Oh." For instance, in response to Tom's excuse, Mary can just respond, "Oh," and go back to sleep. It is an empowering experience not to get caught up in the struggle implicit in the rescuer, persecutor, victim kind of exchange. To not get hooked, to maintain your centeredness, your dignity, feels wonderful. And it means you've taken another step in your own recovery. Why not getting hooked into the games is necessary. To begin with, understand that the game roles we play are not confined to mere verbal exchanges. They extend to the way we play out our lives, and each of us has